Now, introducing our chairman, Lord Waldegrave.
Welcome to another Coutts and Conversation dialogue. And I'm very proud to say that on these occasions, up to 1,000 clients register and many listen afterwards. So welcome to you all. We have a very special guest today. We're very lucky to have Sir John Bell, an old friend of mine and a titan. I think you'll be embarrassed by my saying that, but it's true, in the world of medical science. He's the Regius Professor of Medicine at the University of Oxford. He's the chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation Research Committee, Scientific Advisory Committee. He's chair of the Foundation's Discovery Advisory Group. He's the, in the days when we had SARS, he was the SAR appointed to produce a strategy, and it's been very successful for British biotech. And he's in touch with events all around the world, as well as being a major scientist and himself. And to some of us, he's also, in his spare time, a very important office. He's the senior member of the Oxford University Boat Club, and we've been robbed of our victory this year as one of the minor casualties of the close down, John, haven't we? So welcome, John, and thank you very much for coming on to this program. I've had lots and lots of client questions, which I'll try and weave into the conversation, using first names for reasons of confidentiality. And if people want to submit questions, please use the Q&A function to do so, and we'll try and fit them in. I have a member of our team, a senior member of our team, Camilla Stoll, who's the head of our wealth and investment management team, on standby in case my Wi-Fi goes down, which it might, because I'm in rural Somerset, and Camilla will step in if that happens. So John, going straight into the thick of this, and thank you so much for doing this, there's a huge amount of, and I'm proud of it as an Oxonian and a fellow of a college at Oxford, huge amount of work going on in Oxford. We've all been listening with bated breath, I think, to the accounts of the work done by Sarah Gilbert and her team under your general aegis on vaccines. Would you like to start with that on vaccines, immunity? We've had questions, fundamental questions from Desmond and others about how long immunity lasts. Will we get a vaccine that works? Take that away, John.
Sure. So let me talk just a little bit about immunity, because this is an odd viral infection, and we don't actually know a great deal about the immune responses to this class of virus. As you know, coronaviruses cover a very large number of different types of virus. They often give us the common cold, that's often a coronavirus. And then there's a class of viruses that produce a pretty severe respiratory problem, of which this is one.
Okay. Good.
The first example of that was the original SARS virus, which occurred in and then the MERS virus, which is the Middle Eastern respiratory syndrome, and they're both very similar to this, and they bind, the reason that they're interesting is that they bind to a particular receptor on the surface of cells that's very important for controlling a lot of things, including immune responses. So I'll come back to that in a minute, but the truth is this isn't a conventional viral infection. And I think the reason it has these profound effects is not because it's a virus effect. It's the effect that's downstream of it binding to this particular receptor. So what we do know is that everyone who encounters the virus develops an antibody response, and that starts to occur within days of developing the infection. And at 14 days, it's reached a level where you can measure it in everyone who's had the infection. And the amount of antibody grows until about 28 days. And these are the famous antibody tests that people have talked about. And what we've learned from the antibody tests themselves don't work very well. So as you know, I did a lot of the early work studying the home-based tests, which the government bought rather too many of, I have to say. But it turns out that they're actually not very helpful at the moment at all. But it's the same is probably true about the lab-based tests, is that they do have their limitations. So, but what we can tell is that almost everybody develops an antibody. And if you use the right test or combination of tests, you can detect those. I think the big question that we haven't answered is, does that provide you with immunity going forward? So is that sufficient to protect you? And that, of course, is very important, because if we're developing a vaccine that creates an antibody response, you want to know that that antibody response lasts a while. So what do we know? Well, what we know is that in SARS, the original SARS, people had antibody levels and they lasted a couple of years. So you get antibodies that last a couple of years. But in addition to antibodies in SARS, you also develop the other arm of the immune response, which are T cells. It's a cellular response, and the T cells become very active in that disease, and they stick around for quite a long time, at least 7 or 8 years and maybe longer. And there's been, I think, rather too much talk about the antibodies rather than the T cells, because I suspect the T cells are providing some quite long-term protection. So the real question is, first of all, can we understand that better? Well, in the absence of people getting exposed on more than one occasion, we can't really get good data on that. But with most viral infections, if you mount that kind of response with both antibodies and T cells, you will be protected. And you'll be protected for a period of time. Shortest will be a year, but very often for a very long period of time. So that's really the focus of the development of a vaccine, is to try and generate artificially that type of immunity. And the focus of most vaccine efforts are to use the key protein on the surface of the cell called spike, which is the pointy bit on the outside of the corona, the sort of bits of the crown. And that antigen is quite a potent immunogen. You raise pretty good antibodies to that. And those antibodies, when you find antibodies that neutralize, they're usually to that antigen. So that's why we've been using that. And that's what, to be clear, everybody else is using as well. And so before I give you more data, I just want to paint the picture. And I don't want to depress everyone, because I'll start with the bad news and I'll come to the good news. So the bad news, on average, it takes 8 years to make a vaccine against a virus. So we've been at it about 8 weeks. So you know, I think people got to kind of manage this a bit. This is really hard, and more vaccine candidates fail than ever succeed by a factor of about 10 to 1. The second thing is that there are some viruses where it's never been possible to make a vaccine, and you continue to have the virus circulating in you for your whole life. So, you know, the sort of best example is glandular fever, the Epstein-Barr virus. So, you know, everyone in their teenage life picks it up as part of their romantic journey, and it gives them a few lymph nodes and a fever, and they don't feel very well for a month or two. But then the virus lodges itself in your cells, and it's there forever. So we all have those viruses still with us. Never been possible to make a vaccine to it. And, you know, this is the whole story about chronic viral infections. So I think people have to be quite careful about what their expectations of this. So the advantage in Oxford was we started with a team led by Sarah Gilbert, who'd been interestingly working on MERS, the Middle Eastern respiratory. And she had developed a vaccine for MERS, which was interesting, and she was in the process of testing it, when suddenly this story emerged from central China that there was a new coronavirus that was causing very widespread problems in Wuhan and Hubei province. And so she moved very quickly to clone and characterize the spike protein from the new virus, put it in the same construct. And of course, what we already knew was that the virus that delivers the protein into the cells was completely safe. So it's been into 5,000 people. So we knew that it was a very safe construct. So safety wasn't a big issue. And the real question was, did it produce decent levels of immunogenicity? So we tested it. She tested it in mice, ferrets, and then in primates. And that data is actually quite impressive. So it does show that, particularly the primate data, shows that you can prevent this very severe pneumonia that you get in patients with this disease with a single shot of this vaccine. So where are we now? We've done the phase one study. We've vaccinated about 1,000 people. I can't say exactly the number, but it's quite a lot of people. We're doing immunogenicity now to measure their antibodies. I suspect they'll have very good antibodies, and we're going to move within the next week onto the phase 2-3 study, which will be about another 10,000 people, concentrating in older age groups, because that's the vulnerable population, but also concentrating in healthcare workers and a variety of groups that are a lot more likely to get the disease. So so far, so good. The plans, the strategy will be to get the vaccine, to get data from efficacy data by the end of June, because in that 1,000 people, we'll have some people who've been exposed and hopefully won't have got the disease, and then try and get a phase 3 study done by the end of August so that we could get regulatory approval in September and start vaccinating then. Now, that's the best case scenario, so I don't want everyone to rush off and say, oh, it'll all be fine in September. It probably won't be all right in September, but we'll be getting there one step at a time, and that's the plan.
Thanks. Now, Philip, one of our clients has put in a good question here, which is, have you got enough people to test on? And why not call for young volunteers who are healthy to test on? What are the ethics here and so on? Enough people?
This has been bouncing around a bit. It's been on the Today program a couple of times, and it's obviously an interesting question. And the group, interestingly, the group worldwide that's best at challenge studies is the Jenner Group in Oxford. So we've done more challenge studies than everyone else put together, and we've done them over 20 years. The U.S. regulators won't let people do challenge studies in the U.S. They've always stopped them from doing it. And that's even when you have a salvage therapy. So, for example, we do quite a lot in malaria, and occasionally somebody gets malaria from the challenge, but we've got quinine that we can give them and they get better and it's all fine. In this disease, there is no salvage therapy. So ethically, it gets pretty complicated. And I think that my position, and I think this would be the view of the people at the Jenner as well, is that we're going to get immunogenicity study data this week. So we're going to know whether you mount an immune response. That would be one reason to try and test the vaccine and see whether it prevents disease. But we also are very interested in whether it works in these vulnerable populations. And I think one of the reasons why elderly people get this disease is because their immune systems don't work very well. So most of us, when we hit 65, our immune system, particularly T cells, stop working very effectively. And as a result, we can't really do the efficacy studies without looking at old vulnerable people. And I'm not sure I'd be very comfortable exposing them to a dose of virus, given the fact that if it does take off in those people, they've got a very high likelihood, about a 50% chance they will die. I think that's got ethical challenges. So look, we do challenges in Oxford. We're the world's best. But I'm not sure we're going to go there with this one.
And using young fit people won't give you the info you need.
Not really. Doesn't really tell us anything we don't already know. And that is that they fight off the virus perfectly well. Thank you very much. And that's the end of that. So I don't, you know, I think it's an interesting ethical question to debate, but I think it's a theoretical question in my view.
Now, your answer there gives me a nice segue into therapies, because what's the news on therapies?
Right. So obviously what would be really great would be to have a drug that even just took the edge off the severity of this disease. Because I think what's really terrifying to people is that, you know, if you get the respiratory form of this disease and you're a bit elderly and frail, you have this very, very high mortality. The intensive care units get filled up with people. It's a ghastly disease. And I think that really terrifies people. So if you could just take the edge off it with the drug, it would be terrific. So we developed a program here, and the Americans are just in the process of putting into place a similar program. And that is, we know enough about how the disease works and what is likely to kill you with the disease. And we've got drugs that interfere with those processes. They weren't designed for COVID at all. They were designed for something completely different. But if you could move them across and show that you actually got a very significant effect in relatively small number of patients. So we're doing studies of only 60 people. But if you saw that you had a 20 or 30% reduction in severe disease, then that would be terrific. And there is a very interesting list which we've developed. And indeed, we've got 7 programs in the clinic at the moment. But we're hoping to be able to test about 20 different drugs. And some of them, I think, are very, very promising. So I'll give you a couple of examples. People will be familiar with the drug that it's called anti-TNF. It's a drug that people use for rheumatoid arthritis and a variety of autoimmune diseases. And that its use was discovered by Mark Feldman and Tiny Maney in the UK. It's a great story of UK innovation. And people were very worried that because it's a sort of immunosuppressive drug, if you were on it, you were going to be in big trouble if you got this disease. So, of course, there were a lot of people on it. So after about 6 weeks or 2 months of the disease, somebody went back and looked to say, well, let's look at all the people on anti-TNFs who got COVID and find out what happened to them. Well, it turned out the people on anti-TNF for, and this was for inflammatory bowel disease, that about they had about 116 people who got the disease who were on anti-TNFs. Only one of them died. And 90% of them actually never even were admitted to hospital. They did incredibly well. And if you took a control group, the people who are on other drugs for IBD, about half of them got admitted to hospital and about 15 or 16% died. So you've already got a signal that that actually might be quite a helpful drug. So there's a study going on in Oxford at the moment using anti-TNF led by Mark Feldman. So that's a really interesting story. And then there's another really, this is a crazy story. So there's a drug which is used for killing tapeworms called niclosamide. And it's been around for years. It's generic. It works pretty well if you've got a tapeworm. I suspect not many of your customers have had tapeworms, but it's an enteric drug, which is you swallow the tablet and it kills the tapeworm. It turns out that its active ingredient binds to the spike protein of coronavirus and stops the cell adhesion that produces these syncytia cells, which produces real problems in your lung. And it does so at an unbelievably low concentration. So the group at King's has been working very hard at this, and they've discovered that actually enough of this stuff gets absorbed into the systemic system at the moment, that it should be enough to stop those syncytia from forming. So there's another one. It's on the shelf. Why don't we just test it out and see what happens? So we may have good drugs sitting under our noses, and all we need is good clinical data. So it's a very exciting program.
Taking a step back for a moment, I know that you are a little bit skeptical about tests. I mean, all the tests. I mean, I'm right in that, aren't I?
Yeah. No. So this has not been our finest hour, I'm afraid. So, and I think there's sort of good reasons why there's a problem. So I think, you know, the healthcare system, the NHS and Public Health England, they're not really designed for pandemics. I mean, this is just an exceptional set of circumstances. So I know people have been very critical and said, oh, it's all hopeless, it's all. But the truth is, nobody was really ready for this great onslaught of disease that happened over a very short period of time. So what happened very early on is that the testing, both in the NHS and the Public Health England, found that they were overwhelmed with stuff. And so everybody had to step back and say, look, if we're going to get testing up to speed, how are we going to do it? So I and others were involved in setting up these big centralized labs, three of them across the country. They now do 100,000 a day. We'll soon be doing 150,000 a day, 200,000 a day. Now, we set those up under very, very, very precise standards. And we did it with a lot of help from the company that was involved in it, but also from some of our friends in the NHS. Public Health England. So one of the things that we found is that when we get too many samples, we'll send them abroad. And when you send them abroad, you get really weird results coming back. And I'll point Germany out because everyone says Germany is, they're all so clever, couldn't we all be Germans? Well, that we get these weird results back from Germany, and it turns out that they've not defined a lower limit or a higher limit of sensitivity. They just let the machines run in the corner. And so they're not really discriminating false positives from real positives. So their results are always produced results which are very different than we are. So when you look into this, you find that there are no international standards about where the line should be drawn. Antibody tests, the same. We got a flood of antibody tests. They have sensitivity, in other words, they detect only about 50 or 60% of the people who have antibodies. And they've also got quite a high false positive rate. So if you use it in the population at the moment, you'll get more people who are false positives than real positives because the false positive rate is so high. So we pointed this out to the world about 8 weeks ago based on the data we generated in Oxford. And everybody said, oh, well, that can't be true. But you will have spotted perhaps the FDA withdrew 44 of them from use in the US yesterday. The WHO has said they don't work. Everybody, the Germans have said they don't work. And I think we got there first. But I think the antibody testing has not gone well. And I think one's got to be very careful about saying, interpreting antibody tests, as saying, well, you're protected because you have an antibody test, because we don't know that. But also assuming the test result is even right. Because lots of people have a test and they'll be negative, but they'll still have antibodies. So that's problematic.
So test and track is quite difficult, actually.
Very, very difficult, and made more difficult by the fact that we now know that a very large number of people who have the virus are asymptomatic. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's the commonest single population. So that is to some extent part of the problem. And that is there are lots of people out there walking around assumingly shedding virus, but you won't find them because they don't have symptoms. And if symptoms is the way into this, then it's going to be quite hard.
Taking you back again to populations, one of the oddities seems to me to have been the way, whether or not one believes the Chinese statistics, but Singapore, Far Eastern countries, then a group of Middle Eastern countries, we've had rather low rates. What do you think's going on there? Is this a real phenomenon or a phenomenon?
Interesting question, William. So I'm really interested in this problem because this virus is not behaving like flu. I mean, it really isn't. So let me just give you some statistics from here. If you look at the antibody test, and this is using a very robust antibody test. So I think this data can be trusted because we've cross-checked it in two different ways. If you look at the population here, only about 6% of the population has had this virus. And that is pretty weird for a virus that's got a reproductive index of 2.5, which is a pretty more infected than flu. That is very strange. And then there were a couple of very interesting experiments on the cruise liners where everybody was boxed up. It was a sort of experiment in real time. And actually it turns out that there are quite a lot of people who didn't get infected on those cruise liners, and you would have expected everybody got infected.
Yeah.
So the real question is why is this virus not doing what you would expect it to do? Because it definitely isn't. And I think this has big implications for how we manage the breakout from the lockdown. Because what it looks to me like is that there may well be some existing immunity to coronaviruses out there, which is providing protection to people. And if I told you that actually that type of protection is most likely to be driven by T cells, the cellular base of the immune response, and those T cell responses get much less powerful with age, it could actually explain why we have so many people in the elderly age groups who are so vulnerable, where younger people have much less vulnerability. So I think there's a very interesting immunology story here that we may actually have more existing adaptive immunity to these viruses than we'd expect. Two other data points. Nice paper from San Diego last week in Cell shows that 60% of people, their T cells react to corona-19 peptides. And these are people who've never been exposed to COVID-19. So that tells you there is existing immunity to these viruses. And that's probably why the R-naught numbers don't add up, because R-naught, of course, is calculated based on naive populations, and it looks like we're not a naive population. And the second thing is this really interesting observation. If you take the case fatality rate, and I got this from Pete Davis at Lansdowne, who sends me a helpful note every so often. But if you look at the countries that have had outbreaks of MERS and SARS, and they are in no particular order, Singapore, Dubai, Bahrain, South Korea, they have very, very low case fatality rates. And it's not obvious why they would have it. And that's the number of dead people over the population. So it looks like they've been protected by some pre-existing immunity. And it may well be that those diseases did actually expose more people to the virus than just the ones who died. We focused on the ones who died or were in ITU, but there may have been a wider immunological process going on there. So two reasons to be optimistic. One is that means the vaccine will probably, it'll probably work, and it may work very well because that's the kind of immunity you get. And the second thing is it also means that if you just take the pure antibody numbers and you're trying to get to herd immunity, boy, are we a long way from that now. But if you add in existing immunity to other coronaviruses that's taking the edge off of the population, we may not have to get to 50% of people to get to herd immunity.
That's very interesting indeed. It's a little bit...
All speculation. So people should run off and think that's the answer, but that's my sort of noodling on the subject.
Fascinating. And would have a little bit of a parallel, wouldn't it, as an amateur, having read about the Spanish flu, because they think that some of the... There had been a previous flu, don't they, 20 years before, which had given older people immunity then, which is why it killed younger people.
It's exactly the story. So it was really only people under the age of 32 or 33, I can't remember exactly, that died of the disease or got the most severe forms of the disease. And that was because in 1888, well, you can do the calculation yourself, but anyway, there was a very bad flu that clearly had overlapping immunity. And so everybody who'd had that flu was protected. And the other thing about flu is it looks a bit like this virus. And that is, in a flu epidemic, 90% of people get flu and they don't have any symptoms.
Yeah.
So there's, you, and it's the same with this disease. Most people who get this disease don't get any symptoms. So you get this very large immunologically vaccinated population who've never had any symptoms, who say, well, I've never had flu, but in fact they have had flu or they have had coronavirus. So there's a lot we don't know about this box of immunity, but I think it's really important.
Fascinating, thank you. Now I'm going to take you, before we go to questions that will be coming in from the listeners, back to Oxford for a moment, because Fiona, one of our listeners, sent in the question, you've gone with AstraZeneca. Why AstraZeneca, not famous as a vaccine company?
Well spotted, Fiona. It's a very good question. So there were a couple of things that we were very concerned about when we were looking for a partner for the vaccine. One was that the vaccine's been developed with a great deal of government support and support from funders in the UK. It's been developed in a UK institution. And we wanted to be sure that UK citizens had a crack at getting the vaccine when it was developed. And we did go around the track with a couple of US manufacturers. And they were very enthusiastic to participate, but they did admit that they couldn't be sure that with the current administration in the US, they would be free to supply the UK population, even if we had a successful vaccine in the first instance. And that made those conversations pretty tricky. So we were left really with only a couple of clear options. One was GSK, who are the world's best vaccine manufacturers, without a shadow of a doubt. They're, of course, building their own vaccine. So they sort of said, well, you know, it's pretty hard for us to squeeze up. AstraZeneca actually has all the abilities to do this. They, as you know, they have had a flu vaccine franchise for a long time. They bought the facility, the old Evans vaccine facility in Speke, and they make attenuated flu vaccines all the time, and they're very successful at it. So they do know about vaccines. But what they're really good at is biologics. And this is more of a biologic than a classical vaccine. It doesn't have an adjuvant. It's a virus. You grow it in bioreactors that look like biological bioreactors. And I have to tell you, you couldn't have chosen a better partner. They've been right all the way through. They get it completely. They're committed to supplying the UK, but also it was a real imperative for Oxford to make sure that the developing world got equal access to the developed world. And they've been completely committed to that agenda as well, which we view as being very important.
Well, that's very attractive because it's not a UK first policy like the Trump's policy. We'll have the capacity to do the UK, but then we will certainly be sharing.
Yeah, and we're going to be over manufacturing from middle of the summer, so we'll have stuff to put in developing countries. And we've also, there's discussions with AstraZeneca and a variety of other producers globally, so that we really do get scale, so that if it works, we can get it out quickly.
I am going to make one commercial point, which is that when I was Secretary of State of Health long ago, I had to open the exhibition in the Bodleian of the 50th anniversary from 1940 to 1990 of the first clinical application of penicillin. And we protected nothing in terms of intellectual property. We flew it to America, and as the flying boat arrived in American airspace, Eli Lilly patented the whole thing. And that wasn't a good model of how to go. I hope Oxford does get some reward out of it, and British industry gets some reward out of this.
Yeah, so I think we've got a bit smarter, actually, over the years. We did miss antibodies as well, but that was the other place. But we made a bit of money out of cephalosporins, so that was a good story. And just to reassure everybody, there's a commitment by both AstraZeneca and the university not to make any money. This is all not for profit for the pandemic year. But once the pandemic calms down, this is very likely to be a seasonal vaccine that we all get every year, like we get the flu vaccine. So there's money to be made there, and the university will be getting a royalty out of that.
I'm delighted to hear that. Now, one of the issues, and a couple of plans have raised this, that's been worrying people. There appears to be, even allowing, see whether you think there is an issue, even allowing for the sociology and so on, there seems to be a BAME issue, that people of black and ethnic minority backgrounds seem to be suffering more than others. Is this a real thing, or is this a statistical construct?
Yeah, so it probably is a real thing, but we don't really have the data set to be able to tell you that for sure. What is for sure is the majority of people who are dying in ITU come from a BAME background. There's no question about that. And that's been repeated many times. The problem is that there are other confounders, and that is particularly in the elderly BAME population, they tend to be more prone to some of the comorbidities, diabetes, heart disease, and those sort of things. So that makes them very vulnerable. And secondly, they also come from communities that are often socially deprived, which also makes them more vulnerable. It's interesting because our ONS survey, which we've been doing with the Office of National Statistics, which gives us the only survey which is truly representative.
Yep.
I looked at the data this morning. There is a little bit of difference between white and BAME populations in terms of acquiring the disease and progressing with the disease, but there isn't much. The confidence intervals actually overlap based on the numbers we've got. So I think that my bet is there is a factor there, but it's not been proven.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Now, you're not here to defend or criticize political decisions, and are steering away from that. The truth of all that should be Winston Churchill's famous remark that the scientists should be on tap, but not on top. It's the other people in a democracy who have to take the decisions. But you have left me with a bit of an anxiety about the whole track and trace policy. If these tests are, if we're all walking around, for all I know, asymptomatically carrying the disease. I don't quite see how this works.
Well, this is going to be hard no matter what happens. And I think there are some really good examples of track and trace that works very well. The Chinese have done it very well, and they haven't used testing at all. So they just use, pretty pervasive techniques of the government invading people's private lives and locking people up. So you can get stuff to work. South Korea's done pretty well. They too haven't used a lot of testing for that to work.
Yeah.
I think our testing is as good as anybody's in the world. I have to give credit to the department. They have done a really, really good job. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the tests aren't perfect is not their fault. Mm-hmm. But I think you will get certain amounts of knowledge from that, and that will help. But what's interesting is if you look at the R values or the R naught values across many jurisdictions that have lifted the lockdown, some of them have lifted the lockdown quickly, some have lifted it slowly, some have had lots of disease when they lifted it, some have waited until they had very low levels of disease. They've all got the same R naught numbers now. So I I have a funny feeling that this is going to be okay. Levels are pretty low. There will be the odd outbreak. They can manage that as they go along. I've got some confidence that this will be fine, and we'll be able to get largely back to work. It won't be perfect, but we can do something while the vaccine arrives.
Right. Well, that's encouraging. Now, I've had another question. Incidentally, I should have attributed the question I stole about the American First policy and all that and how that's going to work to Gordon, one of our clients who put in that good question. And another client, Edna, this is an interesting question to me as a former Secretary of State, because we all worship the NHS, but it's a funny creature, the NHS. Nobody actually imitated the NHS anywhere else in the world. And she says, the UK's NHS has often been described as a population-based health system as opposed to an individual prioritized healthcare system, which I suppose is going to the point of centralization and so on. Do you have any views about that? I mean, this is not to criticize the people working it. One of them is my daughter. I mean, they're doing a very good job. But what do you feel about the structures here?
So I'm a real fan of the NHS, as you know. I mean, I think it is a really quite a remarkable institution. To be clear, no healthcare system in the world was ready for a pandemic like this. So, you know, you can look anywhere you like. If you got the levels of disease that we got here, it's been very hard to manage it. And of course, the most overfunded healthcare system in the world is in the US, probably in New York. And they've done by far the worst of everybody. They've done much worse. So I think, you know, it's not so much the amount of money that gets poured in the top, it's how the system is organized. Yeah. And I think one of the things that we've ended up with here, which has been less than perfect, is that we haven't had big modern centralized labs in the NHS. Every little hospital's got their little lab, they make the reagents up in the back room, they do a lot of homebrew tests. And that sort of works fine from day to day, but it doesn't work when you get a tsunami of disease like this, because they just, you know, it's just not possible to keep up. And most other good healthcare systems have big, centralized, highly automated labs that can deal with surges and can deal with increases in flow. So I suspect one of the things we'll have to look at the NHS when we're finished is there not a better way to run laboratory services? Because it's sort of cheap and cheerful in the NHS, and it's sort of fine, but not that fine. So I think those sort of things will improve. Yeah. What I think is very, very impressive is the hospitals have really, they've come through this pretty well. Now, that's not to say some of the London hospitals didn't have a very torrid time. But, you know, there was a big worry that, as they did in Spain and Italy, the hospitals would just fall over. And as soon as they fall over, you're done. And they didn't fall over. So I think there's great credit to the system that we managed to get through it, so at least so far.
Yeah, I think we all agree with that. I mean, our Thursday evening clapping is well merited, I think. Now, we've had a number of questions coming in, and I have certain personal investment in this question, around the effectiveness of vaccines in the over 70s age group. What's your comment on that?
Yeah, so the answer is, if you look at flu vaccines, which are pretty good marker, because it's a respiratory virus. They last a year, partly because the strain changes every year. So they don't have prolonged utility. But it's also true that as soon as you get over the age of 65 or 70, your immune response to those vaccines falls off quite dramatically. And as a result, people have developed better vaccines and better adjuvants, which people who are over the age of 65 get access to, and the rest of the population don't, because we're well aware of the fact that those populations don't respond very well. This is this T cell thing that I talked about before. I think our T cells all get a bit worn out at the far end of life. And that's why it takes a particular kick to get them going. Yeah. But that's, of course, all been integrated into the vaccine studies. So if I speak for the Oxford vaccine, they've taken that into consideration. Lots of the people in the next phase of the studies will be in that age group. And we'll be watching very carefully. And remember, at the moment, they're only using one dose. But if they use two doses, they will get a very big kick to your immune system. So it's an issue, but I don't think it's more. I think it's more an issue to explain the incidence of the disease than it is the vaccine, the effect of the vaccine.
Thank you. We've got a question from David. Well, this is an issue which is wider than all this, but is the world changing towards more autarky? Are people going to come out of this thinking we've got to be more self-sufficient? He asks it in the form of, should the government subsidize pharmaceutical manufacturing capability in the UK so as to reduce our reliance on supply from abroad? Now, the international network has been incredibly powerful in one sense, but local democracies demand things for themselves when push comes to shove.
So I can say this with some comfort because, you know, leading the life sciences strategy for the past 4 years, I have repeatedly said that we needed to develop more resilience on onshore manufacturing. And that was with no knowledge that there was a pandemic coming. But I can tell you, to get the vaccine manufacturing facility built at Harwell was like pulling teeth, I have to tell you. There was, you know, very significant reluctance to get that thing in place. Fortunately, they gave us the money, and then, of course, they've only started to build it now, which is sort of a year and a half too late. But anyway, we don't have any capacity to make biologics at scale in the UK. That can't be a good place to be. So we don't make antibodies at scale. We don't make other biologics at scale. We had no vaccine manufacturing capabilities till we received that funding to build that facility. This is not a good place to be. And I do think future governments, this government and future governments, need to think about this. They need to think about health security, because it is a political reality that no government will be able to produce vaccines and give it to somebody else before they service their own population. I mean, it is what it is. And we can all talk great thoughts about, oh, we'll all put it in a pot and we'll all share it out equally. Not a reality. I think we've got to have our own capabilities onshore.
But as David, one of our clients, says, can you comment on the level of international cooperation between researchers? That's a different question, and it's been very close, hasn't it?
Massive. We have terrific relationships. So we are hooked up with lots of scientists in Europe. The best ELISA, the best lab-based antibody test, actually comes from Switzerland and was replicated from Switzerland to scientists in Harwell and Oxford. It's a spike-specific ELISA. And I think it's probably the only one that's really sensitive and specific. And that came from Switzerland. We're doing a lot of epidemiology with the groups around Europe to understand more about their data. And we're sharing our data very freely. And we're doing lots of things with the US, particularly in drug trials. Our drug trials and their drug trials, we're trying to align. We're helping them set up vaccine trials. We're encouraging people with vaccines in other countries to come and test them here, because we've got a really unique system for evaluating vaccines. So the global environment for research collaboration has been absolutely terrific. And no one's got in the way of that, to their credit. So nobody said, oh, you got to give us the data first. Yeah. Manufacturing's a bit different, but science is fine.
Good. That's great. Good question from Graham. How about you've got new tools, you've got AI. How is AI helping in your vaccine development?
Yeah, I think AI is going to be really important when we get data about the immune responses in people. So when we start looking at both antibody and cellular responses, one thing you can say for sure from the flu experience is you're going to get a wide range of different responses. So some people will be very good at making neutralizing antibodies and other people less good. The diversity of antibodies will be very different from person to person, as it will for T cell responses. And so if you're trying to optimize vaccine strategies, you're going to have masses of data and you're going to have to use AI, I think, to get the answer as to what are the coefficients that really make a difference in terms of efficacy. So it's being used there. We're also using it to try and discover potential new drugs, because you know, we've got hundreds of drugs on the shelf, and we've got to choose the ones that we think are most likely to work. And AI is a really powerful way to do that. So we're definitely using AI tools pretty regularly now in science.
Now, you won't be surprised to hear we've received a number of questions about a second wave and how likely it is. It's probably not a second wave, is it? If I was understanding you rightly, we may have ripples going on for quite a long time. But what's your views on this? I mean, this is the difficulty of handling the lightening of lockdown, isn't it?
No, I think this is the tricky bit. And to their credit, I think the government are going they're taking a very cautious approach, because what we don't want to do is have a big second wave soon that sends everybody back to be locked up for 6 weeks. So they are being rightly very cautious. Mm-hmm. If you let the modelers at it, let's not talk about modeling, but let's pretend you let the modelers at it. They'll predict a second wave in September or October. Mm-hmm. What we've already seen is we've already had one little blip in the West Country, which was simply a group of people getting together, and particularly in large groups, it looks like that's the way this thing gets spread most actively. So my view is we're more likely to see a series of those little outbreaks than a big second wave. And I think there is this big question about how much existing immunity actually exists in the population, because there may be enough there to prevent a major second wave in September. Now, I don't know the answer to that, but you know, there's some strange things about the data that no one, even the modelers, have been able to explain to me. So I think I've got my antenna up. I think it's possible we may get away without a second wave.
Well, fingers crossed. Now, here's a question from Richard. What are the key lessons from COVID for the future of healthcare innovation, process speed, collaboration, etc.? I mean, this is a really good question. As somebody who is a director of a pharmaceutical company, here we're watching, it's rather like Spitfires in 1940. It used to take a couple of years to make them, and then they finally could make them in 6 weeks, actually, when push came to shove.
No doubt. So that's a really, really good question. And I think one of my real objectives in the next 6 months is to make sure we don't drift back to where we were before. Because everybody is performing in this environment with a completely different approach to problems. They're taking quick executive decisions. We're downplaying big, long peer review processes. People are just taking decisions and getting on with it. The regulators have been fantastically supportive. So MHRA couldn't get more plus marks than they've got at the moment. They've just been absolutely terrific. And things like data, where we've always been a bit cautious about healthcare data. Well, you know, if you're gonna stop the epidemic, you gotta have data. So, you know, people have sort of said, well, look, we're just gonna have to be a bit more sensible about data without giving away everybody's health data, everybody on the street. But if you need it to do something important, you should have access to it. And so I think those are all things that will make a difference as we go forward. Because don't forget, you know, we're going into a period where, you know, there is a massive hole in the public finances. Yeah. We have no money. No. And so we are going to have to build industrial sectors that are successful globally, that can compete in this new world. And life sciences has to be one of them. And if we can do anything to make that more successful, then in the end, it'll help close the circle a bit and get us back to where we were. Yeah. So it all does tie up.
It does. Well, more strength to your arm, John. You've been the leader in that. Now, here's a question. How do you explain the significant differences in mortality rates across Europe? Again, are we comparing like with like, do you think, statistically?
So now that I know a little bit about the German testing, I'm not sure we are. But there is something fundamentally different about Germany, which, to be honest, I don't understand, because they have had a pretty easy go of it. And even if you set testing, I don't think that's the result of their testing, because I'm not sure their testing is as special as everybody says it is. But they have done better. And it's very difficult to know, unless it may be some of this issue about the background immunity in populations may be very relevant to this. Maybe the coronavirus that swept through Germany last winter or the winter before, and which was particularly prevalent in Germany, gave people a bit of a boost to their T-cell immunity, in which case they'll have a much better go of the disease on this occasion. So there will be some of those things which will play, but it's one of the curiosities that I think are outstanding about why there is such wide variation. And I don't think it can all be attributed to the quality of their healthcare systems. It's got something to do with, I think, the innate or the adaptive immune response to the virus is my bad. And we won't know that till we've had a better look at what's going on.
And we've got a question from Mark really on that point, which you've talked about, but it is fascinating. He says, what's your view on T-cell therapy versus traditional vaccines? And you've given a bit of that view, but do you want to say anything more on that?
Yeah, so I don't think cellular therapy is going to help, but I think having vaccines that stimulate both humoral antibody responses and T-cell responses is essential. And that's one of the good things about the Oxford vaccine. It does both. It really is very good. In fact, it was developed to stimulate T-cell responses. It also does humoral responses. So Sarah Gilbert has got in that sense, she's riding a real winner there. But there also the ability to make antibodies as monoclonal antibodies that neutralize. And there are some very clever people doing that. You take antibodies out of people who've had the disease, you find the ones that neutralize the virus, and you grow them up as if they were a therapeutic antibody. And those, I think, may well be useful. But remember, they'll only last about 60 days. So it's not a sustainable solution, but it might be very good for healthcare workers, for example, if it gave them protection. So that's all going on. AstraZeneca's got a program, GSK and Vir have got a program, Regeneron's got a program, and they'll be coming out in the summer, I hope. So that's in play as well.
Right. Now, we've got some questions are pouring in, more than we'll have time to deal with, I'm afraid, but it shows how much people are appreciating your talk. I've got one from Matthew here, which I'm not capable of understanding. You will be. Preliminary data suggests that while Charox-1 induced neutralizing antibodies, it didn't prevent shedding. What does this imply for herd immunity?
So it's a really good question, and it's definitely come up. So the story is that in the primates, when they sacrificed the primates after a couple of weeks, after the challenge, they still had virus in the upper airways, in the nose and in the mouth, but their lower airways were completely cleared of virus. And I think there are two important observations. One is these viruses get a massive challenge, much more than you would ever get with a normal exposure. So the fact that they cleared the virus from the lower airways is, to me, quite remarkable, and I think tells you a lot. It is interesting that, A, they had relatively low levels of neutralizing antibodies, but they still had enough oomph to get it from the out of the lower airways. In brackets, is that the T cells or is it that antibodies? And secondly, they did have this viral shedding from the upper airways, which meant that they hadn't completely sterilized the monkeys. Mm-hmm. That may be a dose effect, or it may well be that that's all the vaccine can do. If you had a vaccine that could do that, I think you'd be pretty happy. I don't mind a runny nose from time to time, but I'd prefer not to die of respiratory distress syndrome. We're in the middle of this great question. We don't know the answer.
Now, back to sort of a question that is engaging us all. I know you've got a young son of school age and so on, and I've got grandchildren. What do we think? What about the schools and coming back? Do you have feelings about that? I mean, this is not really so much a scientific question.
No, it's an administrative question. Well, you won't be surprised that I'm interested in this, because our friends across on the Fens in Cambridgeshire have shut up shop for next year, which that's an interesting decision. We're definitely not in that place.
I like that, if I may say so. That's an Oxford remark about Cambridge. An interesting decision. Very good.
So I've been spending a lot of time thinking about what do you do to manage this disease in the chronic phase, as it were, where you don't rely a lot on testing. You have a bit of testing in the background, and you don't rely on a lot of tracking and tracing, which we'll be doing, and that'll be fine. But Tom Hume from Google Ventures, who's an old friend, has been very good at thinking this through. And if you think of it as two key coefficients, one is vulnerability. So you get a one if you're a 22-year-old undergraduate or a 16-year-old school kid. Your vulnerability of dying from this disease is almost nil. In fact, it's probably nil. But if you're a 86-year-old man with heart disease, diabetes, a bit of obesity, and let's say South Asian, then you're 10 on the scale. And there's a massive difference between 1 and 10, both in terms of what you would expose people to and what you would allow them to do and so on. So yeah, that has to be part of the sort of sociology of what we do. And then the other bit of this is the criticality. So, you know, workers who are workers that are we have to have in the hospitals, they get a big score on that because you want them out there. But then there's a lot of people, I dare to say like me, who can do a lot of this stuff on Zoom and sit at home and have meetings and all that sort of stuff. So if you take those two factors and you blend them together, you can end up with a coefficient that should tell you broadly what you should allow people to do. And people can monitor themselves. They can say, well, gosh, I'm a 10, I'm low criticality and high vulnerability. You know, I'm not going to the fun fair this weekend. You know, I just, there's a lot of common sense you can build into this. And I think as part of that common sense, I think getting kids back to school is one of them. And that is these kids are not at risk. Now the teachers are at risk. And in university, I've suggested to our vice chancellor, she sends everybody over the age of 65 on sabbatical next year. Then they won't have any of the old guys who could die of the virus. So I think my view is to try and get back as close to normal as we possibly can. This is not an official Oxford view. I need that. It comes with a massive warning. I don't want the VC on the phone this afternoon. But if you just think about it, I think this will be fine. And we just need to watch and identify the vulnerable people and make sure that they don't get exposed. And I think we can do that. And so, and I think the other important thing, which has been, of course, trailed a lot in the press, you know, there's a massive problem about deprivation, educational disadvantage, because the gap is getting bigger. You know, it's one thing to be sitting at home here where I've got a big house and I've got three kids and I can sit and read the history with my son and it's all terrific. If you're in a tiny place where it's a two up, two down, you got four kids and everybody's squeezed into one room, let me tell you, they are getting no homeschooling. There's nothing going on. And that's a really big disadvantage for these kids. So I think on that ground alone, I would encourage people to go back.
I'm totally with you on that. That's why with another hat on, we've been trying to throw some of our resource from a well-resourced school to help in some of those areas. Now, and incidentally, a footnote on that question has come in from another William. Do we know why the diabetics are at risk? Is there a story about that?
No, we don't, except guess what? Diabetics T-cell function doesn't work so well.
There you are.
I'm not saying that's the answer, but it does add up, I think.
Does add up. Now, we're coming to the last few minutes. And one of the things I know about you is that you're a, I'm not saying you're an optimist. I mean, you're a person who bases their actions on the evidence and on rationality. But a number of the things you've said today have been raised my spirits, at least. It's very easy to get oneself in a sort of perpetual gloom about all this. But there are some wonderful things being done. And as one or two questions have come in, there are going to be things we learn for the future that are going to make us stronger as a society, aren't they? And as a race, actually, as a human race.
Yeah. So just a couple of things. One relates to my Gates function. And, you know, one of the things that we really hope happens is that people take a much more global view about health, because we're all in the same boat together as far as health is concerned, particularly in pandemics. And we need a better system for talking to each other, for surveillance, but also to actually help the deprived countries get access to interventions when these sort of things come along. So that I think is one really important thing. But the other thing, and the reason that I'm, well, as you know, I'm a sort of half full guy, not a half empty guy. But, you know, it's been really impressive to see how the science community has weighed in behind this. I mean, it has been unbelievable. And you've got a lot of smart people who work on completely different subjects who've come along and said, look, I can do this and I can do that. This is how my little device might work in COVID. This is how my new experiment might help. I mean, there are literally hundreds. In one department alone in Oxford, they have 69 principal investigators all working on COVID. And that doesn't include the vaccine guys. So, you know, it's at some level, it's a very uplifting environment.
It's terrific. I think that's terrific. And I've seen direct evidence of this myself, with people from completely different disciplines, engineers, all sorts, coming in and coming up with good ideas. And crisis forces innovation,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Exactly. Yeah.
The thing that's going to need most forcing, and here I talk about my old trade of politics, is actually administration. I mean, the old joke about the Second World War, when the man asked which side of Whitehall was asked which side of the road was the, which side was the Ministry of War on, and the man thought for a time and said, "I think it's on our side." But you know, it's difficult forcing administrative structures to respond. It's easy to make cracks. It's easy to criticize, but it is. We are going to have to learn some things on that side as well.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think they would accept that, look, it's been far from perfect. But I have to tell you that they're trying unbelievably hard. And, you know, nobody's done this before. So I keep saying to people, before you criticize, remember, there wasn't anybody here who went through the 1918 epidemic with influenza. You know, they're not here. So we're having to start all over again. And I have a huge respect for the people who are trying to lead the country through this. It's very impressive.
Well, John, that's a good upbeat note to end on. And thank you so much. And to our clients, I know I haven't managed to get in every single question. I hope I've got in a good sample, and they're brilliant questions. Thank you for them. But thank you above all, John Bell, for joining us today.
Thanks a lot, Will. Take care.
And you.